So you have been extremely busy because you did The Talisman with Stephen King, but you also have reprinted three early novels, including one that I had not read before because nobody had read it other than an agent or two while under Venus. I admit I was thrown off a little about it because I guess I had expected that it would be a horror novel or suspense. There were elements in there that I could see. For example, there was the wolf that appeared right at the beginning on the runway, and I think the wolf, I think it was a wolf or a dog. I was kind
that
of,
was a dog.
Well, it was it was kind of mystical, kind of mysterious there. But it was a novel that was not a bad effort. It was not a bad effort at all. And you were how old when you wrote that?
Oh, it's hard to tell. I was between 26 and 30, I suppose. But if you read it as a thriller, you must have been very disappointed, since it isn't at all.
No.
It was never intended to be.
No.
Certain paragraphs in the blurb are misleading in that way, I think, in the blurb to the collection Wild Animals. But if you read the introduction I wrote, then it's pretty clear that this is not at all a thriller, and I wrote it before I even began to think about writing more commercial kinds of novels. And what I was trying to do, I suppose, was just write a good, straightforward, solidly realized novel with kind of elements of mystery in it, maybe, but mainly the mystery of what is the character going to do, not any other sort of mystery.
Well, let's go back a step further. Let's go back to Marriages, which was your first novel. Tell me how that came about. You were living in Ireland at the time.
That's right. I was living in Dublin. I was a graduate student at University College Dublin, and I was trying to get a PhD by writing a thesis about D.H. Lawrence. I didn't feel as though I was doing very well at this, and I knew that I wanted to write fiction. I'd published a fair amount of poetry at that time, but I wanted to write a novel because I had always thought of myself as a person who did that, even though I had never done it. So when I couldn't stand it anymore, I sat down and wrote about 500 words a day of a novel. And the more I wrote, the longer it got. And one day I was done, and I didn't know what exactly it was that I had done, but I sort of wrapped it up and I put it away in a drawer. And when it became very clear to all concerned that my academic career was not exactly a blazing success, I took this out of a drawer and I mailed it to a publisher in England who took it. And great sighs of relief all around, especially from me. And I then thought to myself, well, this is what I will do now. I'll write fiction, which is infinitely more enjoyable than trying to write scholarly articles. And I'll just kind of push along and see where it goes.
Well, what was Marriages all about?
Marriages was, again, a kind of, it was a straightforward novel about adultery. It was sort of an attempt to write a poetic novel. That is, a novel that wasn't really bound by its narrative limits, but that was more about mood and tone and the language itself and the feelings of the characters involved. So there are problems with it, and probably it could not be published now. If I were a first novelist coming along with Marriages, I think I would have a lot of trouble getting it published, and probably I'd be better off not publishing it. But I'm not ashamed of it, since it represents what I was capable of at the time and what I thought was interesting at the time.
What year was it printed?
73.
Who was the publisher?
Coward McCann in America and André Deutsch in England. That was the first publisher I sent it to, André Deutsch.
Why, when Putnam's issued this omnibus collection, Wild Animals, why wasn't Marriages part of it?
I decided that I would rather forget about Marriages, I'd rather not have it reprinted. It isn't strong enough. It's nice enough, and people can find it if they really want to find it. But if somebody came along and saw that book with my name on it and bought it because they liked books with my name on it, they would be sorely disappointed, even more so than people who read than people who would read Under Venus, thinking it would be a book like Ghost Story or Floating Dragon. And I thought it was too immature, really, to perpetuate. And on the other hand, I wanted people to see where I was when I began. And Under Venus does show more or less really where I was.
You felt that was an advance over Marriages.
I think it's actually a big advance over Marriages.
Even though Under Venus was, you could not find a publisher.
Even though the people who published Marriages turned it down. If I'd come along with Under Venus, first they would have published that and then turned down Marriages when that came. Because that question had far more to do with finance than with art, as is often the case with publishers. But Under Venus is much more realized. I'm happier with it. And I suppose the main point for me is that I was trying to do much, much more, and I knew much more about what I could do in that book. In Marriages, I was a poet trying to see if he could write fiction. And when I came to Under Venus a year or two later, I thought of myself as a novelist trying to write a novel and not create beautiful moments in prose, but trying to tell a story.
Which of your novels do you consider your breakthrough book?
Well, that is very clearly the novel Ghost Story, which was a commercial breakthrough and was the book in which I made probably the greatest personal advances, as far as I'm concerned, in which I discovered for the first time that I really could use a large cast of characters, that I could create a big narrative head of steam and do all kinds of dreamlike, surrealist-like passages and fit them into an evolving, continuous story. And those are things that I worked on subsequently and tried to develop more. So I guess almost all the way around, Ghost Story is a kind of breakthrough book, though the book I wrote after Under Venus, Julia, is another kind of breakthrough, since it proved to me, after what I thought was the failure of Under Venus, that I could write a sustained, continuous narrative and keep the reader's interest and attract more readers.
Do you think that your readers are going to be angry with you when they go out to buy Wild Animals and read Under Venus?
Not if they read the introduction. To buy Wild Animals anyhow, you have to be pretty well committed to the idea that the guy who wrote it was an interesting writer. And it's, in a way, it's a book for people who haven't seen those earlier novels, and maybe even more so, it's a book for people who want to get as much as they can of what I've done. Under Venus, I think, is a respectable novel, and it does show where I came from. It shows where my mind was just before I turned to horror and supernatural writing. And I think you can see in it that I would turn there, that naturalism was a little bit confining for the imagination of the guy who wrote it, and that this guy wanted to break out a little bit and find something a little wilder to think about and to spend his time on.
Why, just parenthetically, why did you change the name of the city in Under Venus? I think it was...
Plachette City?
Plachette City. It was obviously Milwaukee.
Obviously Milwaukee.
Why didn't you just use Milwaukee? It's such a big city.
Yeah, that's a good question, I guess. I don't know. I suppose I have a kind of feeling that Milwaukee, per se, is not very interesting, and that nobody would pick up a novel knowing that it was set in Milwaukee. I know some people who live in Milwaukee who write novels, and I notice not many people read these books. It just seemed to me such an unnecessary handicap. I don't know. You'd have to really do it strongly. Maybe William Kennedy is proof that you can do this, that you can take a boring, bourgeois, uninteresting city and make really interesting books out of it. But Under Venus isn't that, anyhow. And it's not Milwaukee's claim to fame. And though William Kennedy may be Albany's claim to fame in some senses, I don't know. It seemed an unnecessary disadvantage to give my own book.
Do you get back to Milwaukee at all?
Very seldom now, since none of my family is there anymore. Mm-hmm. I still have a number of friends there, but most of them find their way to New York.
Well, it's obvious that you're pleased with your work with regard to the horror and the supernatural. And do you have any intention to return to themes other than those in the future?
Yeah. I would say I'm reasonably pleased with my work in horror and supernatural, to the extent that I think I improved as I went along. I think I got stronger and better imaginatively, and I learned a little bit more about what novels are the more I wrote them. But I don't intend to rest with horror. The Talisman, the last thing I did, the collaboration with Stephen King, is not really a horror novel, despite what some reviewers have said. It isn't at all a horror novel. It's a pretty straightforward fantasy novel that incorporates a lot of modern American material. So it's kind of a nice mixture of a realistic novel plus a fantasy novel. In the future, I plan to stay away from horror, really, for some time. But I don't plan to write books without narrative interest. The next thing I'm going to do is loose. It's about a group of Vietnam War veterans, and there are some spooky and unsettling things in it, but it's not really a horror novel. It's more like a thriller, I would say, but a kind of metaphysical thriller, if that doesn't sound too pretentious.
I can spot your stylistic differences from Stephen King's very easily. Stephen King seems to be a very hasty writer. And I think one of the critics, when they were reviewing The Talisman, said you were more of a cerebral writer, which is absolutely true. But I had difficulty. I didn't read The Talisman very carefully because I was working on Wild Animals, in which I got at the same time. But I was looking for alternating chapters or something so I could better define your stylistic differences. I had trouble picking out who wrote what.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, since everybody should have difficulty picking out who wrote what. There are many passages that we actually physically wrote together, and nobody could tell that because it's impossible. There are many paragraphs that have sentences by him and sentences by me larded through them. On the other hand, the vast middle portion of the book was not written that way, and it was just written kind of trading fours in a fashion between Steve and me. But when we wrote these passages, at first we went to pains to try to smooth out the idiosyncrasies of our own styles and find some kind of common language. And then when that became unnecessary, we just wrote the way we always write, but many times put in false leads so that readers would assume that somebody wrote it when, in fact, the other guy wrote it. And I can't help but notice in these reviews when people go out on a limb and say, well, now I know that King wrote this and Straub wrote this, that most of the time, let us say at least 90% of the time, they're wrong.
Yeah. No, I'm sure they are. I couldn't tell, and I would feel foolish trying to state that if it's too difficult. But how did you trade off? Did you do them by alternating chapters, or how did it work?
We had a big outline, and we wrote according to the outline with many, many divergences, and then finally we scrapped the outline. But we assigned bits that didn't exactly approximate chapters, but sometimes we're like three or four chapters or three and a half or something. There are occasions where we traded off in the middle of chapters. But in the main, one guy did a big block of anywhere between 50 to 200 pages and then traded and then handed that off to the next guy. And the next guy advanced about an equal amount. So that's the way it was done.
Was it fun to do that? Sounds like an awful way to write.
It's not an awful way to write. And if I said it was fun, I'd be a terrible liar. But parts of it were fun, and the beginning was fun, and the ending was fun. For me, being with Stephen King is always fun because he's a delightful person, a very enjoyable guy, and one of my closest friends. So the continuous exposure to Steve King was one of the benefits of the book, I thought. But on the other hand, most novelists are used to being alone, to writing alone, to having absolute dominion over their little sphere. And when you have to share that with a vice king or whatever it is, then it's a little more difficult. And but at the same time,
did I hear you say vice king?
Well, you know, not a vice king, but sort of a a joint king. That sounds even worse.
Oh, joint king, joy. I see.
So no matter what,
I don't
sort
know
if
Stephen would like being referred to as a vice king.
I don't think he'd like being a joint king either very much.
Actually, but, technically, you were alone, though, because you worked in Connecticut and he worked in Maine, right?
Yeah, except for the beginning and the end. We worked apart and then sent information back and forth on our word processors. Some people think that's interesting. Some people think it's disgusting. But it is just mechanics. That's all it is. It was an efficient way to do a complicated project. And en route, I learned that a word processor is a great device for a writer, as most newsmen know, because you can chop and change so easily, and you can make a perfect manuscript with very little trouble.
Who had the final say in The Talisman?
We both had the final say. We did. We had a big editing session in Maine when it was all done with the Viking editor, a great editor, and a wonderful guy named Alan Williams, came up, and we went through it page by page, and I mean, you know, virtually line by line, and we did everything to it that we could stand at that time. And later, Steve and I, then we had a fresh manuscript printed up that incorporated all those changes, and then each of us slunk back into our corners in our various houses and made all the changes that we secretly wanted to make, and those stood. So I had a free hand with Steve's material, and he had a free hand with mine, and then there were no gripes. You know, that was part of the understanding. So so we rewrote each other's stuff. And then there were questions of revision that had to be done, and I certainly revised many pages of Steve's in my own way. And it all went down very smoothly. And I occasionally, now when I pick up the book, I see things in stuff I wrote that I didn't write. And I know that Steve, at the last minute, socked them in. And it's always an improvement, to tell you the truth. I don't think the book is perfect, but it's as good as we could get it, given the fact that we didn't want to become old men while writing it.
Would you do it again?
Long pause. I'm not sure. I would rewrite The Talisman if I could go back to the beginning, and Steve and I were sitting down as we did 4 or 5 years ago, and I would agree to do it again. But I don't think we would ever do another one.
There was kind of a publishing or distribution coup that's not really down your alley, but...
It is, though.
It is? Yeah. You know, is this actually right? The first printing, 500, more than 500,000 copies?
Right.
In the first printing?
The first printing was 500,000, and it's reprinted at least 3 or 4 times.
It's already been reprinted?
Many times. So there are now almost 800,000 in print, and probably there are 800,000 hardbacks of The Talisman in print. And I should be shot for saying this, but I wouldn't be amazed if we sold 1 million hardbacks.
It's wonderful having a millionaire writer sitting to my right. It's wonderful because most writers just they I was talking to a writer from a young man from the University of Arizona who's written a little thin book of short stories published by a tiny little press in Tucson, and he came to New York and walked physically around to some bookstores trying to place them in there. I was as respectful with him as someone with an enormous success as you were.
Oh, I think you must be, because writing is writing, no matter who does it, no matter how many copies it sells, and its merit is determined by internal systems and not by the reading public. But I must say, it is very nice to have the reading public vote for you rather than against you. But it's important to remember, I think, that though Steve King in particular gets a lot of heat for the fact that he is extremely successful, and I also get more heat than is comfortable, it's important to remember that that kind of success came to us, that we did not prostitute ourselves to get it, and that when I first started writing this kind of book, You were making a lot of money if you made more than $20,000 a year. That was all right with me. You know, I didn't threaten to commit suicide out a window if somebody didn't give me hundreds of thousands of dollars. And all I did was write as well as I could, and I was lucky enough to have the public accept it. It isn't that I didn't make a deliberate assault on the bestseller list, I don't think. So it sounds like a weird, complicated apology for one's own success, but the book world sometimes does work by inverted values.
Well, there are books that that tend to be written by committee. I remember Peter Benchley's Jaws. Mm. It was a book that seemed to be written by more than Peter himself. And mm-hmm. But let's go back to the Talisman and the shipping coup there, because maybe you could tell us about that. That's very unusual what they did.
Well, as I remember the story, they secreted copies in warehouses across America. This was a brilliant move. I think they secretly rented space so that they could store all these books, because this is a thick book, and 500,000 or 700,000 copies of it would demand a very large space. And then the purpose of this was so that they could actually put the books in the stores all on the same day. And I think that they came very, very close to doing it, as close as makes no difference, so which is the most effective way to do it from the point of view of selling books, and kind of a triumph of technique, you know, of which they can genuinely be proud, I think.
Apparently, the problem is that some books, some stores get the books before other stores, and
yeah,
thus they lose the business.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. In this case, maybe not, because this book has been selling extremely well now, and came on the list at number one, and I think will remain at one for a while. So,
is it at one now?
Yeah.
The New York Times list?
Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing about this book, which isn't exactly common knowledge yet, but is relates to the kind of insider material in publishing, is that after long, long discussion, we decided not to accept book club deals, and which caused a little fluttering in the dovecotes, since it's not since it seems like going against wisdom. It's certainly going against received publishing wisdom to turn down book club offers, since book clubs give publishers immediate amounts of money. In our case, it was a gamble. We weren't satisfied with what we were offered by the book clubs, and we wanted to see how many more copies we could sell through retail outlets than we would lose by not going to the clubs. And the gamble, if that's what it was, turned out to be a very successful one, since we have easily, by now, made back all those lost sales.
You and King have the same agent.
We have the same agent, an excellent agent named Kirby McCauley.
It's interesting that what you've done here, because the young man I was telling you about a moment ago, who has written this thin little book of short stories, first book,
mm-hmm.
when he graduated from college, he wanted to be a writer. He's a very young man. He said when he was in college, nobody told him about the business side of publishing, the nuts and bolts. What do you do when you're rejected? How do you market the book?
Nobody ever tells you that.
Yeah. No, and he is now teaching creative writing, and he's at the University of Arizona, and he's trying to tell his students something about the business aspects, because he doesn't think that writers should live in garrets.
Amen. No, heaven forbid. Nobody, though, ever does tell anybody these things, and you just have to find them out yourself. And I think that's the way it should be done. I am a little annoyed at times when people I don't know call me up and say, now, I have this book, what should I do about it? Because that, to me, stinks of too much chutzpah, you know. And what I always say is, well, if you don't have an agent, you must find one. Because that really is the first step for any new writer. It's hard to get in the door without an agent. I cannot advise people to seek specific agents, because that doesn't seem just to me, and it seems risky, because those things have to be worked out very carefully between the writer and the specific agent. The point is, you need an agent. Everybody needs an agent at precisely that stage, when there are 30 publishers out there that haven't seen your book, and you want your book to have a shot at all of them, if it needs it. I mean, it's too hard on the spirit to do that yourself. And it's worthwhile to have somebody do it more or less on spec for you.
Of course, you can. I understand that you can go through all 30 publishing houses and then start over again.
And they won't remember that they ever saw before.
No.
Even if they once published
it. That was a wonderful story, wasn't it, about Doris Lessing, who wrote two novels under a pseudonym, and her own publishing house turned them down.
That's right. Well, Bob Gottlieb, bless his soul, did recognize the style and said, now, don't try this on me. But I think it's even more interesting that Jerzy Kosinski, after winning the National Book Award, had that same book resubmitted, everybody turned it down. You know, one guy said, this is like imitation Jerzy Kosinski,
but
nobody else did.
Yeah, well, somebody deliberately submitted it.
Yeah.
I can't remember the guy's name, but he did it to make a point.
Yeah.
Who couldn't sell his... Well, isn't that true?
He couldn't sell his own,
so he said, look, he marketed... Painted Bird, wasn't it?
Steps.
Under his own name, it was still turned down. So, I get a lot of books, a lot of review copies, people asking me to read. Sometimes I just don't have time to look at the book adequately, and I get overwhelmed. And I have a feeling that sometimes editors do that. If they're not bitten by the book right in the beginning or something, if they don't, something doesn't catch their eye, they just may tend to slough it off.
Sure. Everybody's human, and everybody gets tired. I think probably editors do try to do their best, and most editors would be very, very pleased by the thought of discovering somebody new, because that's part of what their job is about, and it's also part of what the satisfactions of their job are about. But there is an unhealthy amount of randomness in the whole process, and there's probably an unfortunate amount of coincidence and luck. But that is the world.
Well, there's also, in particular in your case, a great deal of skill involved, and I want to thank you very much. Congratulations on the Talisman, and I was glad to be able to read the earlier books and in this omnibus collection, and thank you very much for coming back and
chatting.
Thank you, Don. Yeah, I'm going to look forward to putting this together, and I think we covered a lot of ground in a short amount of time.
Good.
Thank you again.
Thank you, Don.